Today on the John Ankerberg Show, many people are aware of the different Islamic groups in the world, from those marching across Africa and across Iraq and Syria, to those in Iran and Saudi Arabia, Egypt and Turkey, to those living in Europe and here in America. People wonder, where do these Islamic groups get their basic ideas? What are their goals? When they quote the Quran and Hadith and say they are following what Muhammad taught, is this true? What does history tell us about Muhammad? How did he live? What kind of example did he lead? What did he teach? And what laws did he establish? Is Islam really a religion of peace? After Muhammad died, how did Muslims follow his teachings for the next 1,000 years? Today, three special guests will tell us. First, Kamal Saleem, who was born in Lebanon and was recruited by the Muslim Brotherhood. He worked with Yasser Arafat and the PLO, trained international terrorists in Libya, and fought with the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. Later, the Muslim Brotherhood sent him to the United States to infiltrate our society and recruit Americans to be members of terror organizations here. Through extraordinary circumstances, he became a Christian. Second is Dr. Emir Kaner, a former Sunni Muslim who grew up in America, where his father built mosques. When he decided to leave Islam and become a Christian, his family disowned him. He went on to earn his PhD in history from the University of Texas at Arlington and is now president of Truett McConnell College in Georgia. And my third guest is the former commander of Delta Force, who later became commanding general of all U.S. Special Army Forces around the world. He is retired three-star general William G. Boykin, who has also served at the CIA in Special Operations, and for 4 years was Deputy Undersecretary of Defense. He is now the Senior Vice President at the Family Research Council. Join us for this special edition of the John Ankerberg Show. Welcome to our program. We've got a special program. We're going to talk about some of the big questions about Islam. We have special guests. We've got two former Sunni Muslims, one who grew up here in America, and his father built mosques. When he came to know the Lord Jesus, his father disowned him. Didn't kill him, but disowned him. Have another one that grew up in Lebanon, and he was on the radical side of the tracks. He was part of the PLO. He also was part of the Muslim Brotherhood and was actually eventually sent to America to infiltrate our society. The Lord wonderfully saved him. We're going to talk about that along the way. And then we've got a famous general here. We've got William G. Boykin, three-star retired general who was commanding general of all U.S. Special Army Forces at one time around the world. He also served with the CIA in clandestine missions, and for 4 years he was Deputy Undersecretary of Defense. He has a wealth of information about this topic, and I can't wait for you to hear it. And I want to just open this up and say, look, we know that in our country and around the world, we have a lot of Christians in name only people. They call themselves Christians, but they don't read the Bible, they don't pray, they don't go to church, they don't intend to follow Jesus Christ. And likewise, we have a lot of Muslims in name only, people that were born into a Muslim family. They don't intend to read the Quran, never have read it. They don't pray five times a day. They don't fast during Ramadan. They don't intend to follow Muhammad. On the other hand, we have Christians who actually follow Jesus Christ, who have devoted their life to Jesus Christ, who do read the Bible and intend to carry out what they find in the Bible. And on the other side, you find devoted Muslims who actually do pray five times a day, who actually do read the Quran, who do intend to follow Muhammad. And what I want to get to is the ones who do want to follow Muhammad. Who is this leader? In most people's thinkings, when you talk about the founder of a world religion, when you think about who that person is, you think of him being peaceful and kind and loving and generous and helpful. That's what most people think. But as I have studied Islam through the years, I have found many surprises when I've looked at the prophet Muhammad. And that's what I'd like to talk about today. And Emir, you got your PhD in history at the University of Texas in Arlington. And I would like you to just give us a brief synopsis here, a background of Muhammad's life.
Well, the most helpful thing to understand to begin is what Moses is to the Jewish people and Jesus is to Christians, Muhammad is to the Muslim people. He is the one that in the Quran, in Surah 48, it says that he is to be praised and celebrated morning and evening. He is the excellent exemplar in chapter 33 and verse 21. And so to Muslims, he is the personification of Islam. He not only was the one to whom the revelation came, but he is the example, the sunnah, the one to whom everything flows. He is asking to be followed in the same way Jesus was followed. So Muhammad, though a tragic story beginning where his father dies before his birth and his mother dies when he's six and he's ultimately raised by a grandfather and an uncle, it's a tragic story to Muslims, a heroic story.
Kamal, over 70 times Muslims are told, commanded in the Quran to follow Muhammad. And I was surprised, and I'd like you to talk a little bit about this. One of the facts, the historical facts of Muhammad's life, did he lead raids on caravans? Did he steal their goods and often kill or enslave the people captured in the raid?
Absolutely. And he was justified by Allah. In the Quran, Surah 22:39-40, Allah gave permission to Muhammad and his people to raid anyone that would rise against them. What is the rising against them? It means for those who do not receive Allah and Muhammad as his prophet. So they have the fullness of this to the point that Muhammad went from prophet to a radical ruler, you know, and so therefore now he was leading his armies and subjugated all the enemy to himself. By the time before he died, all his enemy were subjugated to him, and every 6 weeks, he had a battle against his enemy one way or another.
General, when you were studying the background of what we're facing as a nation, were you surprised to learn the facts about the warrior prophet?
I was indeed, John. What became very clear as we studied the rising tide of Islamic terrorism was that this was a warrior culture compelled by their holy documents to be warriors. And two things came out very clearly to us was a tremendous focus on sex as well as warfare. Those were the two primary themes. Muhammad was a warrior. When he left Medina and came back to Mecca, it was all about warfare. And that's what we're up against today as we are confronted with these Islamic groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS. They are warriors and they are compelled to be warriors because they are being obedient to the Quran and the Hadith and the fatwas that are given to them as being proscriptive.
Yeah. Emir, did Muhammad actually order assassinations on some of his political foes?
You know, you didn't even have to be a combatant. Non-combatants, Persian poets, the Jews of Medina beheaded by 800. You were simply, everything was a religious war, whether it was the house of war or the house of Islam. And so it's set in stone in chapter 9, this prescriptive war where you slay the enemies wherever you find them. They're open enemies to you, chapter 4 and verse 101. The worst of all creatures are people of the book, chapter 98 and verse 6. Chapter 5 and verse 82 says that the enemy are those Jews and pagans. And so the list is not a list of political opponents. They're religious opponents. And Muhammad then sets in motion what becomes the desire of a worldwide conquest. But by the time he dies in 632 AD, he is placed in motion something that we see carried forward even today.
Talk about the poet. I mean, that's also fascinating. What did the poet do that was wrong?
Well, especially today when you hear they want crimes against the caricatures of Muhammad. Here is a Persian poet who, basically, it's satire against Muhammad. There was one poet who said, look, my writings are more beautiful than the Quran. And at the end of that, the answer is to be put to death. And when the poet says, well, what's going to happen to my children? The answer is, hell's fire will take care of your children. That's the excellent exemplar. That's the reason why freedom, true freedom, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, is completely antithetical to traditional purist Islam.
Yeah. Kamal, let me go back. When you were part of Muslim Brotherhood, and you planned certain assassinations of people, did it enter your mind that the reason that you were doing this was because of the example of Muhammad in the past?
Well, when we ran into the field, we were chanting, Muhammad is our model. Allah is our way, you know, and Muhammad is our model. So we modeled our life after the Prophet Muhammad. And so therefore, anyone who would say anything against him, political Islam sprung up to the forefront. Political Islam, to us, it is part of the religion in a way. So therefore, this person was condemned to death instantly. So therefore, we were sent to take advantage of this person or his family. If we could not get to him, we got to his family, and therefore we got him later on.
General, what are the things that are kind of parallels that are happening today that people are actually emulating actions of Muhammad in the past?
Well, if you look at the life of Muhammad, particularly when he came out of Medina back to Mecca and really declared warfare on Christians and Jews as well as the nomadic tribes, there were beheadings. You know, the Quran calls for beheadings. There were actually burning of people, as we have recently seen. There was an effort to subjugate every infidel, whether it's Christian, Jew, or just non-believer. And what you're seeing today is a repeat of all of that, and this has been going on for 1,400 years, although it's had periods where it was not as prominent. But if you look at the Ottoman Empire and all that they did in northern Africa and the southern littorals of Europe throughout history up to the Battle of Lepanto Bay, it's exactly what they're doing today. It's following the lead of Muhammad and establishing the global caliphate.
Yeah. Kamal, let me come back to you on this. The fact is there were two different times. I think Muhammad ordered 600 people to be beheaded, and another time, 800 people. Talk about that.
Well, Muhammad had enemies, you know, and the enemies, the one he painted as enemies. First, he would subjugate them to that painting, and then next thing, he will go after them. The Jewish people, when Muhammad came to the Jewish people in the Arabian Peninsula, and he called them, he said, you know, I am your final prophet. And they said to him, no, you're not, you know. And what happened, therefore, they became radical. And so now Bani Nadir, Bani Quraida, all these tribes, now they were subjugated to death, and he shunned them out all the way to certain sector of the desert, and therefore he went after them and destroyed them by the sword. And there were a multitude of beheading. Even Muhammad himself participated in the killing of the 800 Bani Quraida. Even his wife, Aisha, she sat next to him when she was a little girl, watched him beheading, and that was a commandment.
Emir, the reason I'm bringing this up is not to slander Muslims. It's not to insult Muslims. It's to look at it objectively and say, is this historical? Is this in Muslim books, in their history, the Hadith, the Sunnah? Is this what is there?
And it's in all of those. You know, in the Quran, it's chapter 8 and verse 57, where you have to punish severely your opponents so they learn a lesson. It's in the Hadith, where Muhammad says war is deceit in book 52, which is called Jihad. You have it in the earliest biographies of Muhammad, Ibn Ishaq and others. Even when Muhammad died, one of the first battles was given, and the general came and said, you have to burn the opponents because that was Muhammad's command. So you have to understand it wasn't merely the life of Muhammad. That would have been bad enough. That's historical. But it was that prescriptive action where Muhammad said, follow me. So now you have a bridge to the future. Now you have the conquest, which would take the four rightly guided caliphs, the first four leaders of Islam, and would set in stone their strategy. The strategy that was Muhammad's strategy became their strategy as they carried out history. Now, with the exception of colonialism, this is now coming back to the forefront of how we're going to defend ourselves in the West.
We're going to take a break, and I want to go to the question, did Muhammad actually force people to convert to Islam by the sword? All right, very important question. We'll talk about it when we come right back. Welcome. We're back. We're talking with General Boykin. We're talking with Kamal Saleem. We're talking with Dr. Emer Kaner. And we're talking about some of the big questions about Islam. And we're framing this one with the fact is, if you are going to be a devout Muslim and you're going to follow Muhammad, what are you following? What was his life like? And we're talking about the historical depiction of Muhammad as has been given in the Hadith and other Muslim sources in the Quran, the Sunnah, and so on. And I want to come to this question, which bears on what's happening in the world today. We see a lot of Muslims, ISIS in Iraq and Syria. We've got those in North Africa. We've got Al-Qaeda. We've got others that are forcing people by the sword to either convert, get killed, okay? And I want to go back to Muhammad and ask the question, did Muhammad ever use these tactics, Kamal?
Absolutely.
Let me put a verse on the board here from Bukhari, okay? Bukhari 224. Let me put this up on the screen for people. I have been commanded, Muhammad says, to fight against people until they testify that there is no God but Allah, that Muhammad is the messenger of Allah. Talk about that.
Well, we got to understand that Sirah and Hadith are the jurisprudence of Islam, so therefore that's the greatest majority of Islam. 86% of political Islam is made by Muhammad, and that is the life of Muhammad and traditions. So therefore, when Muhammad in Bukhari, said, "Inni umertu an uqatil al-shu'ub," I have been commanded by Allah to war against the people of the world until everyone says there's no God but Allah and Muhammad, his prophet. And he said, if they do not concede to you, then you have the rights to their women, to their children, to their home, to their land, to their finances, to their government. It is your inheritance. So therefore, he made it clear to them, says, this is your inheritance. Go and have it. But then there's second hadith by Bukhari and Muslim. Both of them verify this. He said, the days of Islam will not come about until the Muslim arise. And what is the arising? Is jihad. In the Christian world, when saying arise and go to reach the people, heal the sick. But in Islam, is arise in jihad and go because you are at war. Anytime when we're looking at, how Muhammad painted these people and now he demonized them, he said the Jews and the Christians are pigs and monkeys. Allah perverted them into that spirit. So what happened, they have the full rights to go to them and say, if you're not going to turn, become Muslim, then we're going to kill you. And now we see it happening with ISIS all over the Middle East.
But people say, well, what about those peaceful verses, Emir? I mean, isn't Kamal taking this out of context? I mean, don't we have these peaceful verses that are really what Muslims should be following?
Yeah, they always quote Surah 2, 256, there's no compulsion of religion, that is sort of their mainstay against the questions of militant Islam, purist Islam. But what they don't realize is you may not have to convert to Islam, but you certainly have to serve under Sharia law, and you will be at best a secondary citizen. And the Muslim has a right. That's why the second leader of Islam, Umar, came up with his own surrender treaty, who then pushed Christians and said, you cannot build churches, rebuild churches. You cannot sing too loudly. You have to give up your seat. That is, they basically became beholden to the Islamic State. And so what we find in whether it's ISIS or Muslim Brotherhood, even in a majority of Muslim countries, now 49 countries in the world are Muslim majorities, in all of them, as high as 99% in Afghanistan, according to Pew Research in 2013, 60% in Africa, all of them desire Sharia law, and 40 to 74% say Sharia law even for the non-Muslim. And this means even the nominal Muslim holds to an Islamic law. And if that's what we're talking about with radicalism, we're dealing with the majority of Muslims across the majority Muslim nations.
When we talk about the Hadith and we talk about the life of Muhammad, is that mandatory for Muslims to follow?
Absolutely. It's the heart of Sharia law. When you look at the Quran and what plays in Sharia law, Quran is only 14%. So the only way they can balance anything in Sharia is to look at how Muhammad lived his life and compare it to the Quran and compare it to the Hadith. And therefore, they apply it to what's happening today. And that is done by what's so-called Shura councils. And so therefore, anytime when we see that the Muslims are doing what they're doing, we are being subjugated to Sharia law because it says so in the Quran or in the Hadith or Sirah. So therefore, in this culture here, we are subjugated to Sharia law when we are allowing them to do anything they want. Sharia law is putting roots in the ground and leading this culture to ultimately change it. You know, when we put, you know, foot bathing, you know, places, or we open places for them at the airport to pray, or when they put the hijab and they work and they could not touch bacon or drinks. All these, you know, we've been subjugated to what they want us to do.
Is it true? One of the surprising things that I read, okay, is that in terms of the Jewish people, there was a time when Muhammad actually commanded and had a Jewish rabbi, a person, brought before him. And what did he do?
You know, one of the teaching of Islam says, an eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. In Islam, when Muhammad and his people lived in Mecca for 14 years, they were subjugated to the Quraysh tribe. They told them, we don't want this Islam, move it out. So therefore, they were tortured a couple times, you know, or more, so they can stop teaching on Islam. So Allah allowed Muhammad to do to the enemy anything that they have been done to him and his people to reflect it upon the enemy. Now, when we look at this Jewish rabbi and what happened, he knew what Bani Qurayza, where they hid all their monies and their gold and all this, and he would not talk about it. Then Muhammad subjugated him to the point that he was burning coal on his chest, and even other places he put stone on his chest, so heavy boulder, that will suffocate him that he will speak. So he was tortured. And this is because he's an apostate. He can do anything to an apostate, even killing him, burning him, or crucify him.
Emir, is this in part why the numbers of Jewish people in Europe right now is going down? Talk about the numbers as they've transpired from 1939 to the present.
Yeah, the echoing words of the Quran, do not take a Jew or Christian as your friend or protector, or you'll become like them, from chapter 5, verse 51. It's now playing out on the stage of history. 1939, you had 9.5 million Jews in Europe. Today, 1.4 million. In much of Europe, you can find police at the synagogues. They're the ones that have to guard them because of what may happen to that synagogue. Of course, what we've seen at the Kosher Deli in France, other things happen just on a random and daily basis. So in Europe now, only 0.2% of its population is Jewish. And it seems in a very terrifying way that Hitler's dream of an eradication of Jewish population from Europe has happened.
Talk about the wives. How many wives did Muhammad have?
Well, after especially his first wife that he seemed to love, Khadija, he would have wives after that, almost a dozen, and concubines and so forth. Of course, he was proud, and the Haditha said he had the sexual prowess of 30 men. Two most controversial marriages, of course, happened when he told his adopted son, I was the one to marry your wife. And so the son divorces and he marries his daughter-in-law. That's probably the second most controversial marriage. The most controversial is found in Bukhari's Hadith in volume 7 and number 64, where he is engaged to a young woman named Aisha. She's a young girl. She's 6 years old when they are engaged. And the Hadith says in volume 7, number 64, they sexually consummated the marriage when she was 9 years old.
All right. Now, again, over 70 times, the Quran says that Muslims that are devout must follow, emulate Muhammad. Compare the life of Muhammad with the life of Jesus Christ.
Well, there is a key difference in chapter 2 of the Quran where it says Allah loves those who do righteous deeds. And so there's a conditional love, if you please Allah. Then it says Allah hates sinners. And so you have the strategy that's played forward with the character of Allah versus the character of our Lord. And with Jesus, who said, love your enemies. Jesus, who himself laid down his life, not merely for us, we who are believers, but for the entire world, why John would announce, "Behold, the Lamb of God that takes away the sins of the world." Jesus Christ was one who shed his blood, while Muhammad was one who shed other people's blood. Christ was one that wanted regard the spiritual. He wished the lost to be saved, where Muhammad wanted the world to become Islamic. So there's a radical difference between the two that not only plays out in their lives, but then in their disciples.
General, when we talk about Christians in name only or Muslims in name only, when you realize if people switch from Muslims in name only to people who actually become devout followers of Muslim, and they're commanded to emulate him in his life, then I think we have a problem. Wouldn't you agree?
Well, we do have a problem, and part of the problem is that is happening in America, not just in mosque in Europe. It's happening in America. Go back to Malik Nadal Hassan, 2009 at Fort Hood, Texas. He made that transition in a mosque in Northern Virginia, right in the shadow of our capital. Anwar al-Awlaki was the actual imam of that, which we killed in a drone strike. But this is happening all over America, that Muslims are making that transition to being true followers of the Prophet Muhammad and his teachings. Now, are the majority in that situation? The answer is no. But do you ever hear anything from the minority, from those that haven't transitioned? You don't. And that is because they are afraid. That is because they see what this government and governments in Europe and governments all over the world do is they ignore that group that haven't made the transition to being true followers of Muhammad and the Quran and the Hadith. They see us as governments trying to appease these people, and it discourages them from being a force against the evil that is being perpetrated in the name of religion. Let me add one thing to what Emer said earlier about being dhimmis or being able to live under Islamic domination, but paying a jizya or a tax and being a second-class citizen and not being able to worship freely. What you see today, especially with ISIS, is you see them just killing people, just simply killing people, because they're Yazidis, because they're Kurds, because they're Christians. They just kill them. They don't give them an opportunity to convert. So it has been a tradition, and there's history behind making subjugated people groups as dhimmis, but they are on a killing spree. They're not giving them this opportunity. And go back to YouTube and look at the crucifixion of Christians, including infants. That's what you're seeing today. They've gone a step beyond.
All right. Got a lot more to say about all of these things. But next week, what we're going to do is we're going to turn our attention to the Quran itself. What is the Quran? What is the message of the Quran? We're always heard you ought to read the Quran. If you do, what will you find in it? I hope that you'll join us then.
For additional resources, log on to jashow.org. That's jashow.org.